General Duncan, Reel 5. I just wanted to take up the arrival of the Vicar's medium, which occurred while you were at Bovington, and ask you if you can tell me a little more about the reactions of the Corps officers to this machine, which was quite revolutionary compared with anything you'd heard.
1923. Absolutely ecstatic, or I'd almost say ecstatic amazement, that we should at last have got something which looked as though it was going somewhere towards fulfilling what a lot of us wanted to see, which is something much faster, better gun power, more reliable, all sorts of refinement, had a self-starter. After all the other ones took four men to start it. And electric lights and God knows what else. And so there was a sort of general air of enormous expectancy about this machine, which was really accentuated by its first arrival. We saw it careering over Bovington at high speed. And it had a sprung track as well, which was another something else we hadn't really dreamt of. And we followed its trials with the keenest interest. They were done by a branch of the Driving Maintenance School, part of Central Schools. And actually, the officer who was detailed to carry out these trials was a great personal friend of mine, but I was kept very well up to date with this, not only with the tank itself, its general characteristics, but also with the defects which it wasn't slow to develop.
What did you learn? What did you learn?
Well, I learned, of course, that something which always amazed me is that manufacturers will insist on using stuff which they think is will do the job, which most people know isn't really up to scratch. My first real acquaintanceship with this came when Roy Jerram, who was the chap who was doing the trials, took one of these mediums over to Christchurch. In those days, the epicyclic gears had a halo brake linings on them. And I know Roy got this thing over onto an island, crossing a bridge which was about 60 or 70 yards long. And when he got over and went to the other side, one of the halo linings broke out, burnt out. And so he had to bring this tank back over these 60 yards with only steering on one side. There weren't any spares, of course. And to this day, I can remember the vividness of his story, of the skill of the driver and the trouble that he had, because he could, in actual fact, only go a very short distance. He then had to swing on his one good steering band. It took a long time to get over there, and gradually, of course, various defects began to show themselves. The tracks were very unsatisfactory to begin with, and this steering defect, the faulty lining, that was checked. And then the suspension bogies were quite appalling. They were sprung. There was a beam which had carried an axle at each end, and bolted onto the axle were the wheels. Of course, being unsupported, being supported only on one side, the wretched things used to sort of flex under load, or at least a continual hammering on one side, and they used to come off, and you would literally see bogey wheel after bogey wheel coming off in a column of tanks. Eventually, of course, somebody had the brilliant idea of casting a big bronze box in which the wheel, the load of the wheel on the axle was carried on both sides, and that source of trouble was eliminated. But it seemed miraculous to us. That was a tank which you could start up in a self-starter, which you could drive for 20 miles in a day and come back again. And this sort of state of mind prevailed. They were used continually, more and more. A second version came out, which had as many snags as the first one. And it wasn't really until Hobo arrived, I think I'm right over this, Hobo arrived in the 2nd Battalion, that the average mileage of the tanks in that battalion was 500, I think, the year before he came. And the year in which I joined the battalion, which was in 32, the mileage was over 1,000 for each tank. And the time I finished, the last year that I was with them, when I was a company commander, the mileage had gone up to something like 2,500.
That was before servicing, was it? Between services?
Well, you serviced them morning, noon and night. I mean, you drove the tank throughout an exercise, it covered 180 miles. You got in at 10 o'clock in the morning. You were given from 10 to 1, and you had some food, you serviced the thing in the afternoon, went out that evening.
Did the arrival of the Vickers medium on the scene have any immediate effect upon tactical thinking in the Corps?
Yes, it did. It had an immediate effect, which developed its full impetus a little later on, because it meant really that instead of moving your tank up to a forming up point immediately behind the infantry and going forward a distance of 2 miles possibly and then marching back to camp or barracks, you were perfectly prepared to move 5 miles out of your camp to your forming up place and move from there on the morning up 3 miles and take part in the exercise, and you were not tied down to the exact movement of the infantry. In other words, it was the first time a converging attack by infantry and tanks became a possibility.
What came first within the Corps? The idea of the Corps as an independent mobile arm, or did the machine come first, out of which ideas like that grew because they were for the first time practicable?
The ideas have been there for a very long time. You see, this goes back to Boney, his 1919 army. The Young Turk, among the subalterns who argued like hell, and the Young Turk arrival, Hobo, Lindsay, Pyle, Broad, all that lot, who were pushing the idea of the tank as an arm in its own right, and not merely as a supporting weapon. That's really the whole crux of the change in thought in the tank corps, which has never been accepted by the army as a whole.
Yes, I'm aware, of course. I mean, who isn't about Fuller's writings and his influence, but he's always struck me as not really typical of RTC officers and not really very typical of RTC thinking until the later period when Hobart and Lindsay and the rest of them did come along. What I'm saying is it sometimes strikes me that in the earlier period, before the Hobart era, not only did the higher authorities think of the tank as an infantry support weapon, but the tank corps itself thought of itself as an infantry support weapon.
So it did, yes. Following, because there were so many chaps who fought in the war before, so much of the pre-war infant, it was only really the influx of the younger and slightly more enterprising, more questing brain, who were looking for other opportunities. And of course, it was only really after the war that Boney began to preach his doctrine of the independent use of armour and armour in its own right. During the war, he was concerned primarily in the tank as it was, and the roles which could be allotted to it within its limitations of speed and range and that sort of thing.
Yes, and it was for this reason that I was wondering whether the arrival of the Vickers medium was in fact a watershed, because earlier, there was every incentive to think upon on the tank as an infantry support weapon because it wasn't much capable of anything else. Yes. On the other hand, the arrival of the Vickers medium, it just struck me as that it would scream out to everybody that here is a machine whose potential would be absolutely wasted if it was tied to the infantry.
Yes, I think that's quite true. And of course, you see, the arrival of the Vickers tank gave a further impulse to the dimly felt but unformulated desire for mobile warfare. After all, everybody sort of think, oh, this is the end of trench warfare, 1919, like famous remark to Boney, now we can get back to proper soldiering again. A proper soldiering really had nothing more to do with trenches and that sort of thing. He'd thought back into the terms of the mobile war, which was always dimly envisaged and never actually crystallized in fact, but on which the maneuvers before the war were broadly based. Mm. And as a generalization, you can say, as you use your infantry to punch your hole, let the cavalry go through. But here was some enormous adjunct to the cavalry in the exploitation phase.
Mm. Let's move on now to...
I ought to have added another note to the gunnery, the history of the gunnery school, because it had continued very much on traditional lines. There was a certain advance in thought. When the Vickers came into service in 1923, from then onwards, of course, the fresh practices were rewritten. There was a possibility that the tank was much more reliable, much quicker, much faster, it had a greater range, and therefore it was possible to extend the scope of the gunnery practices at Lulworth to some extent. In fact, you almost got to the stage of thinking of a shoot from tanks, from a section of tanks on the move, instead of merely just one tank stationary firing at a target. And this went on. It didn't make any really substantial progress until Charles Ball arrived to take command of the gunnery school in, I think, 1925. And then, my goodness me, it's all about the winds of change. They blew hurricane force there, because Charles revolutionized the whole thing. He was an extremely able and very capable gunnery officer himself. He'd been a gunner. He knew all about guns. He was in the forefront of the thinking about the tank as the independent arm, and he was quite determined that the emphasis should be swung from the mechanical side to the gunnery side. The difficulty always was that you had to take out five tanks. If you didn't bring five tanks back, it was no bloody good. And so there was a great tendency to look on the actual physical movement of the tank from place to place as the hallmark of a good section, company, battalion, whatever you like. Charles began preaching gunnery to no mean tune, and the standard of gunnery and the standard of the firepower demonstrations at Lulworth went up and up and up.
How did he achieve that?
Just by sheer demand. It's the same thing. If you set the standard high enough, you'll get it, you see. But he began to think about the theory of shooting on the move. That began to be taught at Lulworth for the first time. Infinitely greater attention was paid to things like calibrating guns, if you like, that sort of thing. Instead of doing it in a very rough and ready method, you began to get down to sort of a measure of precision shooting.
Did he develop particular exercise to develop these skills?
I don't really quite know. I was only there as a student. I didn't see this. The end product was passed on to me. But when I came back to the gunnery school to do my instructor's course, the atmosphere was entirely different. The previous atmosphere had been very largely on, what shall I say, the individual skill resulting from constant practice drill on the weapons, and the firing. Yes, it was important, but it wasn't all frightful. It didn't matter. The target was too big anyhow. Therefore, provided the chap knew his drill and could keep his gun in action, and could a line is typed with reasonable accuracy. And then Charles came with his insistence on firing at greater ranges and firing with greater skill, and began to talk about the amount of aim off according to the range you were firing at and the speed you were firing at. And if you like, he began to introduce a pseudo-scientific approach to the problem, which made an enormous difference. And this again was bumped up tremendously by a visit which somebody paid to Weyland. Gunnery school always had close liaison with Weyland, who taught us our gunnery in the first case. And Weyland produced the RIPA, which is the abbreviation for roll your pitch and alter course, which was the thing that and the Scott Dotter, which comes from Admiral Sir Percy Scott, which were the things which had revolutionized the naval gunnery training. And the RIPA really was a movable platform controlled by cams, which made it tilt like that and roll back and forward in the same way that a battleship or a cruiser or somebody rolls. Well, they were frightfully excited about this, and eventually they managed to get enough money out of the Treasury to buy a RIPA from the Navy. It was installed in one of the gunnery schools, one of the gunnery schools' instructional huts, at the time that I was on the course. And I was one of the students who fired on the very early RIPA experiments. It was fascinating. It was no good to us, because a battleship rolls like that, you see. And you had three cams, or four or five cams. You drove at high speed into a quartering sea, into a beam sea, into a head sea. And according to whether it was the conditions which were preset, so you set the cams, and the old RIPA rolled like that. We had to take all the cams off and cut them so that they went up to the cam like that and then dropped like that, as a tank does. But that was the start. And then there was a chap called Lakeman, Tom Lakeman, who began to cock an air rifle alongside so that you would do practice with towed targets on a miniature range.
How were you simulating movement?
Simulating the whole of the rifle. The rifle was a cage built out of expanded metal and ordinary angle iron. It had a gun with the controls in it. And the controls, of course, that was really the basis of the whole trouble, because the traverse wheel went like that in that plane, and the elevating wheel went in that plane. So if you saw people, any medium tank battalion as you went to, before it went to Lulworth, you would see people with abstraction sort of going round like this, you would see, sort of thinking to themselves up and down and so on, until really it became absolutely instinctive before you got there, that as the tank rose like that, so your hand came down to bring the gun down and to keep the turret traverse on the right stage. It sounds very trivial, this, but you see, this was a thing which spread through, first of all through the instructors, then through the students, then it came back into battalions, and then it got eventually down to the soldier. And Charles's insistence on the value of training there and the standard that he was expecting people to attain when they got to Lulworth, coupled with his absolute refusal to accept anybody but the best, no instructor was taken on any at the gunnery school without a D and a jolly good one, and the chaps who went up to their standard were just sort of booted out. And again, the standard of instruction rose enormously. Because instead of learning by rote out of a series of notes, the question and answer sounds ridiculous, you see, but this is back in prehistoric days. You taught your classes not by the instructor reading off a parrot phrase, a great chunk out of the room, but by asking the student questions which would bring out the answer which the instructor wanted. Ergo, the first thing we had to do was to raise the standard of the instructor. As you raised the standard of the instructor, so up went the standard of the students. And it became a sort of self-accumulating snowball. It was a fascinating time to watch. See, and this is the thing, really. This is one of the compensations. See, this has been going on all the time, absolutely continuously. Somebody's been arguing about this, and somebody's been going on and on and on and on about it. This was the time when you got the gunner operator in. You couldn't pay a gunner. There's no trade union pay for gunner, but there is a trade union pay for a driver operator, for an operator. And so we were able to bring in the driver operator and the driver gunner, which got them trade pay if they were sufficiently high standard. And they would only get to the high enough standard to qualify for this pay if the instructor out of the school was good enough to get them up there. Mm. Ergo, up went the demand on the school. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating time.
Did Broad introduce any other new kinds of equipment at Lulworth or new exercises when you were doing that instructor's course that hadn't been present in your earlier visit?
No. I was lucky. The syllabus had been revised. It had been completely revised from what it was when I did my recruit officer's course 4 years before. Mm. It was much better. It was much wider in scope. The standard of instruction was much better, and the standard demanded from the students was much better. Much better.
As a layman, I would expect in a gunnery course for some attention to be given to the tactical use of tanks. Was that developed at all?
Yes, and I think you've been quite right. And of course now, you see, they've got a tactical section, and we do the course, you do a week with the tactical school. In those days, it wasn't there. It wasn't there. There was a measure of insistence on concealment and the advantage of concentration of fire. And for a very, very long time after that, manoeuvres were concentrated on crossing ahead of the T, the old naval thing, so disposing yourself so that. Yes, this did come out. This was a tactical doctrine which was taught continually, that you were to manoeuvre yourself and your command in such a way that you concentrate the fire of five tanks on one. But how to do it? Exercises out there? No, not really. I mean, we used to go on the way out to the range, or when you got to the range, if a ship passed through the danger area, your instructor would say, well, now you're coming up from here and the enemy is over there, what are you going to do and how are you going to do it? From that point of view, but that was, as I remember, it was an interlude in the general gunnery instruction.
Mm. That concept of concentrating the fire of five tanks on one tank seems to imply that at the basis of the gunnery teaching was the idea that the tank existed to fight other tanks.
Well, now, this is or at least, this was the germ of the idea, which the rest of the army as a whole has failed to recognize, I think. And that is that until the enemy tank is destroyed, you will have no control over the battlefield. Now, this is the thing which the army has always found the greatest reluctance in accepting. And I think you'll probably find many of my contemporaries won't agree with me now, but I personally hold that until the enemy tank force is destroyed or immobilized by minefields, by fire, by artillery fire, by air power, by anything you like, until that is right, your own troops haven't got liberty of maneuver.
Yes, but the question I'm asking you is, was that philosophy reflected in the gunnery training you got at this time in 1925, was it all concentrated on?
Answer.
No, I don't really know that it was. I think primarily the object of the course was to turn out good gunnery instructors. The emphasis being on the gunnery. That thought, if you like, was probably present. It was again a thing for discussion. It wasn't, I don't think, actually definitely taught in period.
Yes. I'm still not quite clear about this. Would turning out a good gunnery instructor at this time mean someone who could train gunners in various kinds of tank gunnery roles, i.e. tank v. tank, tank v. machine gun position, tank v. enemy infantry units, and so on?
I see what you mean. I think that the answer there really was that the gunnery instruction was devoted to the application of the main armament or the auxiliary armament on targets which might be point targets for the gun or a row of targets for the machine gun. We were taught a considerable attention was paid to the distribution of fire, the lateral distribution of fire, the application of fire to infantry targets from that point of view. Targets were placed out in ways which suggested to you that you had to, it was necessary to take up, if you like, differing positions in relation to your targets in order to bring fire, whichever weapon you were dealing with, to the best advantage.
Yes, this is I think this is a terribly important point, which is why I'm sort of labouring it a little. But can I then conclude that the gunnery training at this period, as far as its objectives were concerned, was multi-purpose in the way we've been describing?
Oh yes, it was. It was multi-purpose. The application of either kind of fire, either machine gun or main armament fire, to targets which were of importance, to targets for which the particular nature of fire was best suited.
That's fine. And I have laboured this because when you first described the gunnery course, I was getting the impression that the end purpose of the course was to train tank gunners in shooting at other tanks.
Oh yes, no it wasn't, no. No, it was to train instructors, to train gunners to apply fire to whatever targets came before them to best advantage.
When you went to Belfast in September 1924, joined the 12th Armoured Car Company, what kind of duties were you engaged in there?
No particular duties. We were not used in any form of aid to civil power at all. We did a lot of section training for really, as far as I remember it, for putting cordons around suspected areas, for patrolling various areas. One exercised the soldiers in movement under cover of other cars and that sort of thing. A lot of gunnery, but it was very difficult because there were very, very inadequate training areas, and with a 4.5-ton rose, it was jolly difficult to get off the road, especially in Ireland, where the ground was so frightfully wet and boggy. Mm. Coupled with that, of course, it was intensively farmed as well. So really, except for roads and tracks in particular, there wasn't an awful amount of variety of stuff that you could put the soldiers over.
Was the employment of armoured cars in Ireland significantly different from their employment in the other areas you'd been engaged with them, particularly Egypt and Palestine?
No, it wasn't really, but the only thing was that we'd moved on a bit. We knew much more about it. We'd had experience of armoured car work. I certainly, anyhow, had a much better idea of what I was really sort of driving at and what I was training my soldiers to do, what I wanted out of them, really. And most of your training was devoted to the possible roles of armoured cars in a mobile warfare role, with particular reference to that application to cordons and reconnaissances, if you were ever required to do that in the aid of civil power. It was a very explosive situation. You see, the army was, if you like, popular and unpopular. I mean, you took the cars out and you caused a traffic jam in the main street of Belfast, and somebody asked a question in the Houses of Parliament that day, like that. But any suggestion of moving the units with a whole bloody place got over enough in arms. They're quite incalculable, I came to the conclusion.
Weren't you beginning to feel, being associated with armoured cars at this time, that you were in the sort of backwater of the tank corps? Because light tank development had gone on apace, and not much had been happening with cars, had it?
No, light tank fire was only just beginning at that time, 25, you see. It was the lighter tank had come in. But from what I heard of the exercises, although the